Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So get a load of this. It is, in fact, possible to have too much money. Just ask Apple why the company finally decided to part with some of its billions on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast from Monday, the 19th of March. Good as always to have you with us. $601.10. That was the close for Apple today. Could have been because the new iPad had a record opening weekend. Or it could have been because for the first time in 18-some-odd years, the company's going to be giving money away. CEO Tim Cook announced a dividend this morning. Investors will get $2.65 for every share of Apple that they own. Our New York bureau chief Heidi Moore explains that with as much money as it had in the bank, Apple didn't really have a choice.
When I think of Apple, I think of Donald Duck's uncle, Scrooge McDuck, doing his daily dive into his giant bin of gold. After all, Apple's been sitting on nearly $100 billion of cash. Jason Voss at the CFA Institute for Financial Analysts counted it out for me.
Apple has 3,200 years that it could spend a dollar a second and not run out of money, which is the length of written human history, essentially.
Having that much cash is actually not a good thing. You know how you get a pathetic 1-2% interest rate on the money in your savings account? Well, it's the same for corporate America. Here's Voss again.
The question as a shareholder is, why can't I have some of that cash?
Companies like Apple or Microsoft can sue their investors by giving them a quarterly dividend. It's a regular payment of cash.
Having dividends is a sure thing.
That's Robert Posen, a lecturer at the Harvard Business School and a former vice chairman of Fidelity Investments. Steve Jobs, Apple's late CEO, opposed a dividend. He thought it would be like admitting that Apple is an old-fashioned, slow-growing company that has to pay its shareholders cash to keep them happy. Apple considers itself sleek and fast-growing. Oliver Porcia is the president of Gary Goldberg Financial Services, which is an Apple shareholder. He says Apple investors want it all, both cash and growth.
Every quarter, the clock starts anew for them, and they have to sell more iPods, iPads, iPhones, and i-whatevers.
One thing that keeps growing is the company's stock price. A share of Apple in 2009 was worth $90. Now it's close to $600. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Got 90 bucks. That's amazing. Whatever other problems they're going to have this year, say, on the field come opening day in a couple of weeks, the New York Mets aren't going to have Bernie Madoff to deal with anymore. Today, just as a trial about it was about to start, the owners of the Mets settled a lawsuit over Madoff's massive fraud. They've agreed to pay back some of the money they made in that now infamous Ponzi scheme. The ballpark number is $162 million, which, since there had been talk of almost twice as much, helps ease the financial strain on their baseball franchise. And at the same time, it adds to a growing pile of money that's been recovered on behalf of Madoff's victims. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has the update.
Legal experts say today's deal could encourage settlements in other pending cases against banks, investment funds, and hundreds of individuals. Tom Ajami is a business law attorney.
The allegations were that the facts of the fraud were so extremely obvious that one would have to turn a blind eye to not know this Ponzi scheme was going on.
The Mets owners denied the allegations, but Ajami says the trustee representing Madoff's victims has been especially aggressive in clawing back money from those who profited.
It sends a message that if you see signs of a Ponzi scheme or you suspect something's odd, you can't just keep taking money. You have to be responsible, and you may ultimately have to pay back that money one day.
So far, more than $11 billion has been recovered out of $17 billion Madoff took from investors. Law professor Peter Henning has been following the Madoff case at Wayne State University.
It looks like investors could get maybe even as much as two-thirds of each dollar back, about 65 to 70 cents. And that's far better than you see in most Ponzi schemes if investors get back a dime.
Henning says it's unusual there's been so much money to recover. He notes that the biggest share, $5 billion, came from the widow of a single investor.
It ends up there are some deep pockets out there. You don't see that very often in Ponzi schemes because most Ponzi schemes tend to prey on middle class and lower middle class, not the very wealthy.
Henning says only a small fraction of the recovered money has been distributed. Most of the funds are tied up in legal challenges, and he predicts it will take at least two or three more years to sort that all out. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
A note now to the airline passenger public. There are about a bajillion things that have to happen between now and what I'm about to tell you actually coming to pass. But the Federal Aviation Administration says it's going to take another look at the rules for electronic devices on airplanes. New York Times blogger Nick Bilton knows a little something about that. He's on his cell phone now at Kennedy Airport in New York City, fresh off a flight from San Francisco with the details. Hey, Nick, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, how was the flight, man? Did you have enough to read?
I did, but I didn't have anything to eat, so I'm a little hungry. But other than that, I had to bring some print magazines with me to help pass the time, though.
Well, tell me about that. I mean, you are an inveterate e-reader user. Lots of people are. And now you say the FAA might be taking another look at this.
Yeah, so I've written a bunch of columns about the fact that we aren't allowed to use e-readers and iPads and things like that on airplanes during takeoff and landing. And the rules that exist have been around for some time, but they don't actually make sense. And they were actually incorporated way before these devices existed. And so I called the FAA several times and kind of annoyed them. And when I called them this time, they said that they're actually going to start looking into investigating whether they could start using these things on flights again.
What does that exactly mean, though? I can't imagine they're just going to say, okay.
That's a great question. I think what it means is that they have a lot of work ahead of them, a lot of bureaucracy and a lot of red tape. The way that the FAA approves devices for airplanes, and currently there's only about four different things that are approved, and that includes electric razors, hearing aids, and bizarre contraptions like that. But the way they have to do it is they have to send a flight up with no people on, just the pilots, and then all this testing equipment, and then they actually have to test the devices. So if you see the American Airlines pilots that now have iPads in the cockpit,
yeah,
that was what they did to be able to test those things. So they're going to have to do that for Kindles and Nooks and all these other things too.
Just to be clear, because people will certainly want to know about this, we're not talking about using phones on airplanes yet, are we?
Absolutely not. Okay. No, that is not the what people are really, I think, looking for is they want to be able to, rather than, you know, if people don't want to print book and they have a Kindle they've spent $100 on or an iPad that they've spent $500 on, they want to be able to read a book during takeoff and landing on that or a magazine or whatever it is. And the current rules don't let you do that. And I think that's what the FAA is going to start looking into. It's not about cell phones.
Nick Bilton, he writes the Bits blog for The New York Times. We got him at Kennedy Airport in New York City. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
On Wall Street today, all Apple all the time with surprisingly meh results. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. With the nationwide average for a gallon of regular gas at $3.82.9 this week, we're pleased to be able to tell you this. A number of car companies are soon going to be making cars that run on hydrogen. The hydrogen powers fuel cells that generate electricity without pollution. The bad news is you're not going to see them on the roads anytime soon. From Washington, Sabri Benishore explains.
In 2009, American Hydrogen died.
This was a tough call. I think there was centered mostly on saying that hydrogen for vehicles is not near term.
That's Energy Secretary Stephen Chu 3 years ago, explaining to senators why the Obama administration had decided not to place its bets and taxpayer money on hydrogen-powered vehicles.
There are real issues that I have. The most problematic, in my opinion, is we still have not figured out how to store hydrogen in a compact form. The other is the infrastructure. We would have to create a totally new infrastructure in order to have the hydrogen vehicles be fueled.
That didn't stop foreign car companies, including Toyota, Daimler, and Honda, from pushing ahead. Hydrogen cars are coming.
Certainly the goal is to commercialize the vehicle, you know, in a big way.
That's Craig Scott, manager of advanced technologies at Toyota. Toyota has already developed tanks to store hydrogen in a compact form. He says its car will be three times more efficient than a Prius. It'll debut in 2015 at an estimated starting price of $50,000 that he says will drop sharply after that.
The plan is to roll them out into select markets that have infrastructure that can support the car.
That is basically code for Germany and Japan, where hundreds of hydrogen fueling stations will be built in the next few years. That's not happening in the U.S. Joe Rome is author of the book, The Hype About Hydrogen.
I just don't see anyone who has the money.
It'd cost at least tens of billions of dollars. In other countries, the government has subsidized this process, but not in the U.S. And Rome says there's another reason not to push hydrogen here. It's not that much cleaner.
The overwhelming majority of hydrogen in this country is made from natural gas, and it releases greenhouse gases when you convert it to hydrogen.
Technology may resolve that problem in the long term, but emissions aren't actually the point right now, says Alan Crane. He's a senior scientist with the National Research Council.
The big advantage of the fuel cell is that it's much easier to get an equivalent vehicle to what people have now functionally. You could several hundred miles range, you could refuel very rapidly.
So really, what'll usher in the age of hydrogen will be consumer convenience for consumers in Germany and Japan. In the U.S., we're going to have to wait a while. I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
All right, so here's a thought. What if, and bear with me here, but what if this whole presidential campaign on both sides of the political aisle was all for nothing, economy-wise, I mean? Because really, if presidents or governments could do something to fix the global economy, don't you think they would have already? Alan Beatty is the author of a new book called Who's in Charge Here? How Governments Are Failing the World Economy. He's also, as it happens, the international economy editor for the Financial Times. Alan, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Let's test the premise here, right? Because the subtitle of this book is How Governments Are Failing the World Economy. And granted, they are, because we're still in a global recession. Europe has its problems. America is slow. What, though, specifically aren't governments doing right?
Well, in Europe, the way the dominant, let's for the sake of brevity call it Germany, the dominant mode of thinking in Europe with to do with the Eurozone crisis is this is all a crisis of profligate governments, is of governments spending too much. In reality, with the odd exception of countries like Greece, which is actually a bit of an outlier, most of the Eurozone crisis is not really to do with profligate governments. You know, Ireland and Spain went into the crisis with very low government debt. It's all to do with credit bubbles and reckless banks lending against rising housing markets on the periphery.
It's tough to argue with the basic premise that governments are failing the world economy, right? Because if they were doing the right thing, we'd be in a different place economically. The question, though, is what's the option? What choice do we have?
Well, I mean, you can see the choice that has been taken in the U.S. over the past two or three years. You know, there has been some fiscal expansion. There could have been more. A lot of people who are worrying that if the U.S. government borrows more, there'll be high inflation, long-term interest rates will rise, it will crowd out private sector investment. I think that's just been comprehensively disproved by the facts. So what they really need to do is stop the focus in the short term on screwing down on government spending, realize that the way to get debt down is actually to get growth.
You know, the American economy, much less the global economy, is this enormous, intractable beast, right? And I wonder if it's even fair to ask who's in charge, because how do you handle something as complex as the global economy?
Well, you know, attempts to kind of guide individual bits of the global economy and really to micromanage often go wrong. The role of government is to provide a framework in which the economy can grow. You know, anyone who says President Obama or President Bush or anyone has created X jobs is clearly talking nonsense, unless they are literally talking about jobs in the White House. but that doesn't and should not give carte blanche to governments to intervene everywhere they like, you know, favoring their individual industries, trying to go back to those kind of failed micromanagement policies that you saw in previous decades.
How then do we get from here to there? Because you, as a student of global economies and perhaps American politics, know that that's no easy thing.
No, it's not. I mean, all economies, not just the US, but all economies often take crises to move. So who knows? It may very unfortunately take another crisis for the real lessons to sink in, or perhaps as a massive political cataclysm. I think it's going to be hard to shake the basic pattern of gridlock that we're in at the moment.
Alan Beatty is the international economy editor at the Financial Times. His new book is called Who's in Charge Here? Alan, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up,
the number one concern right now is finding skilled people.
Because we need them to run highly skilled machines. But first, let's do the numbers. Talk of dividends lifted Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials gained 6 points, less than a tenth percent, finished at 13,239. The NASDAQ picked up 23 points, 0.7%, 3078, 3078, the number there. The S&P 500 added 5 points, 0.4%, settled at 1,409. S&P hasn't been this high since May 2008, if you're keeping track. Told you earlier that Apple is going to pay its first shareholder dividend in almost 20 years. The stock polished up more than 2.5%, but Apple's shine is not rubbing off on Sprint. Analysts are worried the company's not going to sell enough iPhones. News of lower earnings expectations pushed Sprint stock down 4.5% today. Mixed news on this Monday from the financial sector. Bank of America shed nearly 3%. Wells Fargo and Citigroup deposited 1%. Other stocks in the black today. U.S. Steel fired up 6%. Company says steel prices are recovering. UPS soared 3% after making a deal to buy TNT Express. That's a Dutch company. The acquisition will make UPS the largest market player in Europe. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.37%. It's interesting. It's getting up there. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for February. The House Armed Services Committee discusses recent developments in Afghanistan. And Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke kicks off a four-part lecture series for college students. Tomorrow's topic, origins and mission of the Federal Reserve. Bernanke will be talking to undergrads at George Washington University. Transcripts and video recordings will be posted online. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. So back before there was Lin Sanity, Jeremy Lin and the New York Knicks, there was Tebow mania. Tim Tebow and the Denver Broncos and their unlikely winning streak last season. Despite all that, though, it looks like Tebow is going to be on his way out. Peyton Manning, late of the Indianapolis Colts, as you might have heard, has chosen Denver as his new home, which means Tebow is on the trading block. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
Four-time NFL MVP Peyton Manning is trading in one horse-mascotted team for another. Reports are the QB will sign with the Denver Broncos after he was cut by the Indianapolis Colts. Andrew Brandt is a sports business analyst for ESPN.
I think this contract will be in the range of $18 to $19 to $20 million per year.
But what about the future of craze-creating quarterback Tim Tebow, who led the Broncos to the playoffs last year? Reports are the team will look to trade him. But is there a market for the unconventional and uneven QB? Here's Brandt again.
Beauty is going to be in the eye of beholder in terms of value, but I'll tell you this, Tim Tebow will energize a fan base wherever he goes.
But if Tebow doesn't produce, it's not clear how long those fans will stay interested. CBS Sports' Charlie Casserly, who's also a former NFL general manager, just isn't sold.
Personally, I don't see much of a market for him.
The reality, says Casserly, even if Tebow might sell a whole lot of tickets, he still needs a whole lot of work. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
In case it slipped by unnoticed, this past weekend marked 6 months since the beginning of Occupy Wall Street. Protesters tried to move into Zuccotti Park in Manhattan on Saturday. And I say I tried because the NYPD was having none of it. The occupiers hope to recapture some of the energy and, to be fair, some of the attention they had last fall. Commentator Kim Clark says the protesters can grab headlines with their chants and their slogans, but we really ought to be listening to Wall Street.
The Occupy Wall Street protesters have gotten lots of attention, even though their complaints are vague and they don't really offer any concrete solutions. We should pay more attention to the people who really occupy Wall Street, the people who work there every day directing the flows of billions of dollars. They know exactly what the problems are, and they know how to fix them. Now, these one percenters are not going to join hands with anarchists and start singing Kumbaya. The real Wall Streeters are all for income inequality. They think people who are smart and hardworking should get more money. But many top Wall Streeters say tax laws, prosecution policies, and business practices are funneling America's riches to the influential, not to the deserving. They argue that to free the invisible hand of capitalism to improve all of our lives, we need reforms to bring back equality of justice and economic opportunity. Take, for example, Burton Malkiel, author of the investment Bible, A Random Walk Down Wall Street. He told me he's really mad that people with regular jobs can pay tax rates of 30% or more, while hedge fund managers pay only 15%. And Wall Street's top mortgage securities analyst, Lori Goodman, has found that struggling homeowners pay mortgage bond investors higher returns when banks trade principal reductions for shares and profits when the home is sold. But most big lenders are refusing to do this because they lose fees and have to take some immediate losses. That's why Wall Streeters say the real fixes must come from Washington. But they worry that both political parties are so beholden to wealthy donors that they don't have the spine to protect investors or taxpayers. So maybe the real solution is for taxpayers to occupy Washington.
Kim Clark is a senior writer with Money Magazine. Write to us. Email works best. letters@marketplace.org, or you can find us on Facebook, too. For all the talk of the long, slow decline of American manufacturing, the fact of the matter is that lots of stuff is still made in the USA. And that includes places like Michigan, where reports of manufacturing's death turn out to have been greatly exaggerated. Because even if you drive a foreign car, there's a decent chance that thousands of parts in it were made right here. And a lot of those parts, and a lot of parts for everything else in your life as well, were made possible by one particular kind of machine. Dustin Dwyer from Changing Gears explains.
CNC stands for Computer Numerically Controlled. And what the computerized machine does is it machines things. That sounds ridiculous. Unless you know that machine is not just a noun. It's also a specific manufacturing process. It's when you cut away or sculpt a material.
Machining is at or very close to the foundation of manufacturing.
This is Peter Zielinski. He's senior editor at a magazine called Modern Machine Shop. And he says even if you've never heard of it, CNC machining is essential to your life.
Any product you pick up and touch, it's not too many steps away from a machining process.
Most of the parts in your car engine come from a CNC machine. Medical devices, your kitchen cabinets, CNC machine. Your computer case, your iPhone earbuds, well, no. But the mold that created them, CNC machine. Zielinski says the growth of these machines represents the biggest change in manufacturing over the last 20 years. The people who run them are factory workers, but they also have to be computer programmers.
So it's T1. M6 is a miscellaneous function.
Steve Henkelman is a teacher at Grand Rapids Community College. He's explaining the CNC machine's programming language. The machine itself looks like a big gray box with a computer hanging off the side. Trent Oren is one of the students here. Oren says he has friends who do other more traditional manufacturing work. CNC machining is nothing like it.
They're in more of the automotive, so going to the bar right after they get out of work as opposed to when I do, it's night and day difference. They're covered in oil and I smell like daisies.
And the pay's not too bad either. Trent could come out of this 18-week class and get a job that pays $10 to $15 an hour. More experienced machinists can make $50,000 to $60,000 a year, and they don't need a four-year degree to get there. Right now, manufacturers are desperate for these workers.
These are the CNC machines.
Mike Hellman is one of the people looking for a skilled CNC machinist. He's head of human resources for DisplayPak, a company in Grand Rapids. DisplayPak makes that impossible-to-open clear plastic packaging. The molds for the packaging are made on CNC machines. Hellman's been looking for a machinist for 3 months with no luck. Only a couple years ago, DisplayPak had to lay off machinists.
Where did those people go? Did you try calling them?
Some, yes. Some were working, had other jobs, or have moved away or just gone.
Last year, the Manufacturing Institute surveyed companies and found that as many as 600,000 jobs are going unfilled in this country because there aren't enough good workers. And the biggest chunk of that number is for skilled production workers, including CNC machinists. Peter Zielinski says it's one of the biggest problems U.S. manufacturers face.
It wouldn't be competition from China. The number one concern right now is finding skilled people.
And that's really the future of manufacturing in this country. Smarter workers, smarter machines, with computer numerically controlled machines at the heart of it all. In Grand Rapids, Michigan, I'm Dustin Dwyer for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a bit of context for a news item you might have heard this morning, that the Treasury Department is $25 billion to the good from its investment in mortgage-backed securities that it bought during the financial crisis. Toxic assets is another word for those securities. The $25 billion is a line item profit, but it's best to remember the money Treasury shelled out to buy them isn't all that the government spent. Back then, there are billions that were invested in AIG and car companies and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac as well. It is indeed a complicated balance sheet that this country has. All right, that's it. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow gained 6 points, less than 0.1%, finished at 13,239. The NASDAQ picked up 23 points, 0.7%, 3,078. The S&P 500 added 5 points, 0.4%, settled at 1,409. Our producers include Gina Delvec, Justin Ho, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.